You should have no fear that this mountain will fall from my hand. And don't be afraid of the wind and rain, for your deliverance from these afflictions has already been arranged. Their minds thus pacified by Lord Krishna, they all entered beneath the hill, where they found ample room for themselves and all their cows, wagons, servants and priests, and for all other members of the community as well. Purport, all the domestic animals of Vrindavan were brought beneath Govardhan Hill for shelter. Lord Krishna, forgetting hunger and thirst and putting aside all considerations of personal pleasure, stood there holding up the hill for 7 days as the people of Raja gazed upon him. What I like about this pastime is that the hill became so that the hill was able to give shelter to all these animals, to all the people of Vrindavan. And in one of the commentaries here, I just see it now. From the Harivamsa, the Acharya has also quoted Sri Krishna himself as saying, Trilokyam api utsahate raksitum kim punar rajam. Sri Govardhan can give shelter to all the three worlds. What to speak of the simple land of Raja? So that is like one of the mystic questions about the whole Govardhan pastime, that all those cows, I mean, you know how many cows, right? So just anywhere in Vrindavan you could hear the cows, you could hear bulls fighting, you hear descriptions that Nanda Maharaj had 900,000 cows, that Maharaj Vrishabhanu had 200 million cows, or 2 million cows, sorry. Just huge numbers. And if you start calculating how much space they needed, and it doesn't match, you know, Govardhan would not be able to give shelter to all such, so many living beings. But they easily fit, easily. And as we see here, Trilokyam api utsahate rakshitum kim punar rajam. Sri Govardhan can give shelter to all the three worlds. What to speak of the simple land of Raja? Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur said that due to the ecstasy, Govardhan could give shelter to so many more. He grew in size. And that, of course, is we are not arguing with the commentary of Krishna, of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. But looking at it, we also understand that Govardhan is Krishna, and that it is really Krishna who is giving shelter, and that Krishna is beyond the modes of material nature, and that therefore it's also indicating how Krishna can give shelter to unlimited living beings. There's no limit to the shelter that Krishna can give. So I think that's an important point, and we must think about that. Yeah, something to meditate upon. That's why I take that out. I discuss that point because otherwise we begin to think that Krishna consciousness is exclusive, that it is for a limited few, maybe people with special karma, maybe, you know, those who were already great devotees in last life, a few, but not a mainstream, not for everyone, definitely not for everyone, but it's very much for everyone. I've sometimes thought, like, if you tell people out there that a program of four regulative principles is the program for the whole world, they look at you like the whole world. You know, maybe a few monks, a few nuns, yeah, and a few people like that, but for the whole world. But it is for the whole world, because it's truly anywhere below that is basically animal life. That's what Prabhupada is stating. Right? That's animal life. And that may have become the standard, fine, you know, but human life means this. Their minds, thus specified by Lord Krishna, they all entered beneath the hill, where they found ample room for themselves, all their cows, wagons, servants, and priests, and for all other members of the community as well. When Indra observed this exhibition of Lord Krishna's mystic power, he became most astonished, pulled down from his platform of false pride and his intentions toward it, he ordered his clouds to desist. There is a commentary where basically after the whole incident was over and after Krishna had again put down the hill and so on, that Krishna one day was found at the site of Govardhan Hill inspecting all the damage that Indra had done. And it was at that time that Indra came with Surabhi and so on. And a discussion also came out. And in that discussion, Krishna says, he says, my dear Indra, how could you do this? How could you send this devastating rain and really a rain with the idea which is meant to kill? Right? And how could you as a devotee act in such a demoniac way? It's not befitting a devotee. And Indra is saying that I was proud. And then Krishna says, yes, but when you're proud, you have to control pride by intelligence. And then Indra said, yes, but I was angry and therefore I lost my intelligence. So in this way, it's explained how Indra could act like that, because it's kind of, the demigods are devotees and Indra is not an ordinary person at all, he's very much a devotee. So how could he act in this way that he just practically wanted to kill all the residents of Vrindavan? It's very interesting. So, seeing that the fierce wind and rain had now ceased, the sky had become clear of rain clouds, and the sun had risen, Lord Krishna, the lifter of Govardhan Hill, spoke to the coward community as follows. Lord Krishna said, my dear coward men, please go out with your wives, children, and possessions. Give up your fear. The wind and rain have stopped, and the river's high waters have subsided. After collecting their respective cows and loading their paraphernalia into their wagons, the coward men went out. The women and children and elderly persons gradually followed them. While all living creatures looked on, the Supreme Personality of God had put down the hill in its original place, just as it had stood before. All the residents of Vrindavan became overwhelmed with ecstatic love, and they came forward and greeted Sri Krishna according to their individual relationship with him. Some embrace him, others bowing to him, and so forth. The coward women presenting water mixed with yogurt and unbroken barley corns. Sorry. Always fall asleep after breakfast. All the residents of Vrindavan were overwhelmed with ecstatic love, and they came forward and greeted Sri Krishna according to their individual relationships with him, some embracing him, others bowing down to him, and so forth. The coward women presented water mixed with yogurt and unbroken barley corns as a token of honor, and they showered auspicious benediction upon him. Yeah, a nice culture also, huh? In that village of Vrindavan. so centered around the cows and around grains from the land. So an honest life, not the artificial life that we are in. Mm. And we see how that was, yeah, all part of also Brahminical culture, auspicious items, yogurt and unbroken grains. Mother Yasoda, Mother Rohini, Nanda Maharaj and Balaram, the greatest of the strong, all embraced Krishna. Overwhelmed with affection, they offered him their blessings. In the heavens, O King, all the demigods, including the Siddhas, Sadhyas, Gandharvas and Charanas, sang the praises of Lord Krishna and showered them flowers in great satisfaction. My dear Parikshit, the demigods in heaven resoundingly played their conch shells and kettle drums, and at the best of the Gandharvas, led by Tumburu, began to sing. Tumburu became later Narada Muni. Surrounded by his loving coward boyfriends and Lord Balaram, Krishna then went off to the place where he had been tending his cows. The coward girls returned to their homes, singing joyfully about the lifting of Govardhan Hill and other glorious deeds performed by Lord Krishna, who had so deeply touched their heart. Okay. And then the next chapter is called Wonderful Krishna. And then, basically, the residents of Vrindavan, they just begin to spend their time with that, just remembering how Krishna performed many of these amazing activities and who he was. Krishna Chakravarti Thakur. During Lord Krishna's pastime of lifting Sri Govardhan Hill, the coward men simply enjoyed the spiritual bliss of the Lord's activities without analyzing them. But afterwards, when they had returned to their homes, perplexity arose within their hearts. Thus they thought, now we have directly seen child Krishna lift Govardhan Hill, and we remember how he killed Putana and other demons, extinguished the forest fire, and so on. At the time, we thought that these were the ordinary acts occurred because of a benediction from the Brahmanas and because of Nanda Maharaj's great fortune, or that perhaps this boy had achieved the mercy of Lord Nityananda and was thus empowered by him. But all these presumptions are false, because an ordinary 7-year-old boy could never hold up the king of the mountains for 7 whole days. Krishna is not a human being. He must be the Supreme Lord Himself. But on the other hand, child Krishna loves it when we cuddle him, and he becomes morose when we, as uncles and well-wishers, simply worldly coward men do not give him attention. He appears to become hungry and thirsty, steals yogurt and milk, sometimes plays tricks, tells lies, chatters childishly, and tends the calves. If he's actually the Supreme Lord, why would he do these things? Don't they indicate that he's an ordinary human child? Mm-hmm. So this double identity of Krishna is there. Prabhupada is saying that about worshipping the universal form, and he's saying that... He said the universal form, the one described in the Bhagavad Gita with the many mouths and the many arms and so on. Prabhupada said, how can we relate to that personality? You cannot dress him. Right? It's not possible to dress the universal form. You can dress the deities, but not the universal form. That's too much cloth. Where will you get all that cloth? Yeah. So... when Krishna is acting like a child and so on, then he is within our realm. You know, we can deal with him. We can reach him. So, and that's Krishna's intention. So Krishna is not at all far away from the human world and just living in another type of world, you know, and is so great that we cannot understand him. And no, he's purposely creating a whole reality, spiritual reality and a human reality which are very close.
Very close.
With nature here and nature there. Okay, it's a little nicer over there, obviously, than here. I mean, here you're one day outside and the next day you're in a stuffy room, whatever may be. But it's like that. Chai. Yeah, it needs the gorilla approach. Yeah, so it's nice that Krishna has simultaneously these sides. He, and that's what these pastimes are about. He lifts Govardhan Hill, then he's superhuman, then he's like, obviously, he swallows forest fires, he kills witches like Putana, which are kind of a little large, and so on. But he's also very human, and that change between the two is the interesting mix in Krishna. The human side makes him very, very accessible, and we can have a very close, intimate relationship with him. He's a child. Everyone has to care for a child. So it's like, it's very close. And at the same time, then, lifting a mountain, no problem. So that is wonderful. And that, of course, is why Krishna is so unique and why all other God concepts fall short. You know, like, you see, it's like if you speak about, okay, here's God, you know, all right, God. Who is God? God is the all-powerful. God is the source of everything. God is the greatest. Nice. But where does that place us in relation to him? That places us in relation to him far away. Yeah. When he's great, the greater God is, well, the more we become aware of our own insignificance. So in front of the universal form, we are really like, all we can do is just stand there in shock, and stand there overwhelmed. Arjuna was overwhelmed. It was just too much. It was just more than he could deal with. And therefore he said, okay, please take your original form, right? I mean, don't stay like this. But that's so. This is a unique feature of Krishna consciousness. And that is why we claim that Krishna consciousness is superior. Right? Yeah. In Durban this year, it was interesting. In Rathi Yatra, we had this interfaith stuff. Muslim sheikhs speaking and so on, and our devotees, and then they emphasize he's the greatest, and it's all kind of mystical, yeah. Like yes, it's at one point it was speaking about the names of God, and then I was like, he has 99 names, right? 99 names. Okay, that's what it says in the Muslim literature, Quran. 99 names. Fine. He has 99 names. Right? We're not in disagreement with it that he has 99 names. You know, we would agree with all these 99 names. But there's also the Vishnu Sahasranam. He also has 1,000 names. Right? But we don't say that doesn't mean that he doesn't have 1,001 names. He also has you know, 1,000,000 names. Right? There's no end to his names. Yes. So in this way, we see descriptions. But when we see descriptions of Krishna, then not only is it attractive, but there's it also. It's about the intimacy. It's about the intimacy. Yeah. It's about the relationship. So, in Krishna consciousness, we emphasize the relationship. That is our interest. And like, whereas we see in many other traditions, they try to establish God exists, and then they establish the position of God. Yeah. Here's the position of God. Yeah. But, and then or even the mercy of God. This morning I also I emphasized the mercy aspect in my lecture, and that is nice, the mercy aspect. But it's not enough to say that he is merciful. Then we have to qualify that mercy. And the mercy is not only about pulling us out of the material world, but the mercy is also about giving us the spiritual world and giving us an eternal activity, an eternal engagement. And here we see something about the eternal engagement. When Krishna comes to the material world and performs all these pastimes, then he shows us a bit of the eternal engagement. And then, as we are reading about it, we begin to see that this is very close to us. Huh? Just like, yeah, the time when Krishna wanted to. This is after the Ekadasi. Nanda Maharaj took his bath in the Yamuna, and he was too early, and he got arrested by the servants of Varuna. They grabbed him. They brought him before Varuna. And, Nanda Maharaj was shocked. He went into the river, and next moment he's standing in front of Varuna. Last thing he ever imagined, that in this life he would see Varuna. I mean, no one would think that that would happen to us, but it happened. Then, in Vrindavan, meanwhile, alarm! Nanda Maharaj went underwater and he didn't come back up. You know, so it's like big alarm, and Krishna immediately, you know, gets ready, tightens his dhoti, and just like jumps in the water. And next moment, Krishna is also there, appearing in front of Varuna. And as soon as Krishna, first of all, Nanda Maharaj is still looking at Varuna seated on a throne, all opulence, this and that. And the next moment, Krishna is there, and Varuna comes off his throne, falls on the ground, offers full obeisances to Krishna, and says, finally, after many, many lives, this one has become successful, because in this one, I'm getting the darshan of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Nanda Maharaj like, sort of goes like, Varuna? My son Krishna, Varuna, paying obeisances, saying that my son is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And it's like, so Nanda Maharaj's mind is sort of like, and when such an authority as Varuna is saying it, then Nanda Maharaj is believing it. So Nanda Maharaj is still sort of shocked, and Krishna says, well, Varuna offers some prayers, but Krishna says, no, thank you very much, some other time, but we really have to go now because the residents of Vrindavan are in great anxiety. So he takes Nanda Maharaj by the hand, they go up to the water and they come out of the Yamuna. And everyone is like totally ecstatic, and then the news is out. Nanda Maharaj tells everyone, Krishna is God, because Varuna says, and everyone says, God, oh, believe it, this is amazing. All this time, God lives in our village, and we never knew. Just see. Imagine, God would be amongst one of us. So all this time, imagine that we just find out that Sri Govinda is God, you know. What to do, you know, and we all go like, God, Sri Govinda, you know, you really fooled us, you know. You really fooled us all this time, you know, you were God and cheating us. Now that you're God, you got to show us something, yeah? Show us a trick. Maybe you can lift the castle for us or something. That would be good. We would want to see something. So the same happened. The residents of Vrindavan said, okay, show us that you're God. Can you do some trick? Krishna said, yeah, sure, what would you like? I don't know. Someone said, maybe show the Brahma Jyoti. Krishna said, Brahma Jyoti is very boring. You know, maybe I should show you Golok. He said, that's a great idea. Show us Golok. So Krishna showed Golok, and it was exactly the same as the village of Vrindavan. None different. Yeah? So the only thing was the Vedas personified were there, these effulgent sort of personalities. So when the residents of Vrindavan saw this whole village, it was exactly the same as their village. They kind of liked that, and they're wondering, who are these effulgent personalities? Scratch their head about them, but for the rest, they saw the spiritual world. But at the same time, they had their village relationship with Krishna, that intimate relationship with Krishna. And because of that, they were not so interested in anything else, didn't care so much about seeing the spiritual world. Well, it's the same as our village, nice. So that relationship with Krishna is very much described and how they interact, and that was the essence. That is the whole essence. So so not only that Krishna is God, in fact they forgot that Krishna is God. They didn't remember. After some time, you know, although everybody now knew about it, it wasn't new anymore, you know what I mean? So people stopped talking about it. Yeah, same thing. Yeah, Krishna's God. Yeah, everybody knows. You know, so then they stopped talking about it, and in fact, gradually they even forgot about it. Nobody talked about it anymore, and they just forgot about it. So our point is, we are. It's about the relationship. It's about the intimacy, and it's about, love of God. Love of God means loving everything about Him. Loving the way He plays His flute, we discussed yesterday. Loving His lotus eyes, His lotus hands, which are ready, His lotus mouth, His lotus navel, His lotus feet. And everything about Krishna is lovable. That's the whole idea. Okay? So, not just love of God, you know. I mean, do you have love of God? I have it. Okay, great. What is it? It's love. It's love. All right, you know. Tell us something more about that love. You know, well, it's just a very great, great love. You know, it's like it's just everywhere. It's like love. Yeah. So it's not like that. It's love. We, yeah, we love the way Krishna is dealing with his devotees, right? We love it that he's stealing prasadam. We love it that amongst the coward boys they steal lunch packages. We love it that Krishna is playing his flute in a way that no one can imagine. We love it that he is into word games. I mean, there are things to love. You know, so love about Krishna, it's not just love of God, you know, but it's very concrete. It's, and there is more and more to discover, right? And all that is to be loved. So in this way, love of God is a very clear thing. It's not vague. It's not like love. You know, it's universal. It's like all inclusive. All right, you know. No. We love Krishna's wonderful Krishna. Krishna's wonderful pastimes is very amazing pastimes because he's so human and then so superhuman. And it just interacts. And that's really like... yeah. That makes it exciting. There are so many pastimes. Questions? And water. Comments, discussion, 1 hour of everybody saying something.
Imagine the comments in reference to Lord Indra that he should control his pride with intelligence. So I was wondering, the humility of conscious effort, is it even natural with those conscious effort?
Yeah, apparently. At least for a conditioned soul it is, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it eventually comes natural, and I often feel that humility and honesty are linked with each other. Because, you know, we're not perfect. Yeah? It's like we all make so many mistakes, yeah? All the time. Yeah? So when you're honest, then it's not a problem to be humble, because you can say, you know, in Dutch there's a saying, more luck than wisdom, you know? And that's how it is. It's like, I remember when I, you know, like was into football, that one time, somehow or other, I made a goal. Don't ask me how, you know? But I was at quite a distance from the goal, and the keeper was standing a little far outside the goal, and I just like sort of made a very high loop right over him, plump, into the goal. How it worked, don't ask me, you know. So, but of course I wasn't a Vaishnava in those days, so you know, somebody said, wow, that was a beautiful goal. Yes, of course. Whereas I couldn't have done it twice, you know, that just worked that one time by miracle. It happened like that. I don't know, so many devotees wrote so many offerings, but someone wrote something about the tortoise that is in an ocean and that then it comes up, and then somehow or other there's a plank in the ocean with a hole, and its hole, its head goes exactly through the hole, you know, of that plank, right? As he's coming up out of the ocean. Prabhupada's example says it's like that rare to somehow or other find a spiritual master. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, and if the tortoise starts saying, like, yeah, you know, well, you know, it was easy, you know. I mean, that's so by nature we are in a humble position. Right? So it's our natural position. You know, we're tiny, frail little human beings. Right? I mean, certain powers around us are so much greater. So it's like, therefore, as soon as we acknowledge the mistakes that we made, as soon as we acknowledge our limitations, then humility is also easier. So through intelligence, we can remind ourselves of these limitations. Just look, you know, Prabhupada sometimes put us through these exercises. What were you doing yesterday at the same time? Yeah? Sitting in the park. Or what were we doing the day before yesterday at the same time? And the day before that, and the day before that. You know, it's like, do it a few times, and then anybody gets lost, even someone with a super memory. So, we are very limited, really. And so with the intelligence, one is meant to remind oneself or one's own limitations, then humility becomes easier. Rukmini.
Marjorie, the first question we read, it was mentioned that Krishna overcame the power of the tendency to eat or drink. I'm just wondering where the
power is. Krishna doesn't need to eat and drink. But he's always eating and drinking. It's like Nanda Maharaj is saying this when they say that he is God. They say, how can he be God? This, you know, he's a problem boy. He's a problem case. He's always, you know, always eating. Very lusty boy. Yeah? At home, if you know what we feed him, the best, you know, the best. His mother is going through so much trouble to feed him the best. Yeah? And then he has so many cooks for his mother cooks for him, Balaram's mother cooks for him, Radharani cooks for him, everybody cooks for him. He eats all that. Yeah? And then next he goes to the house of the neighbors and he eats there again. And he takes breakfast in the house of many people. And after that, immediately he goes stealing yogurt as well. So Krishna is known for eating. He's definitely known. Eating is like eating is a big part of Krishna's pastimes. He is always eating. His devotees are also always eating. So, but he showed you in Govardhan that he's actually not dependent on eating. He doesn't need to eat. He doesn't become weak when he doesn't eat. If I wouldn't eat for 1 week and I have to work, guys, I look, you know, like. I must admit, during the Queen's Day, I ate a little bit more than usual. I don't know if you did, but I was like, in the lunch break, I had a voracious attack. Wasn't it, Janani? Just laughed. I'm supposed to end with these pills, and he always comes, the pills. Not pills, Janani, it's prasad. Again, he comes back with the pills. No. I think he came 10 times with the pills. He does that, he's very subtle. When he thinks I've eaten enough, he brings out the pills. But Krishna, you can lift Govardhan Hill and fast at the same time. He's not dependent for strength on what he eats or anything. So that's why he's overcoming the hunger and thirst and not eating, to show he's actually not dependent on these things.
The residents were under the Yoga Maya, conditioned souls were under Maha Maya. Would we ever be under Yoga Maya, or is that way out of our jurisdiction in this?
No, Yoga Maya is already. So there's Mahamaya for the conditioned souls, and yoga maya is going on in the life of the devotees. So they may already, Krishna may already use yoga maya on you now. Little Mahamaya may also still be there. Those who don't have a question yet have to think of one. Because I won't let you get out of this room until you ask anyone who has to ask the questions to stay here for the rest of the day. So if you want to go early, like 12 o'clock, you better ask a question quick. Yeah.
I was just thinking because of the eating under the Govardhan Hill. I heard from Kina Bandran, you know, did from the Ananda Vrindavan Champu. That well, they should have got worried that Krishna didn't eat enough. So there was several devotees who felt that they were also responsible for holding the hill. One was Marumanga because he was chanting mantras. I thought I'm a Brahmana, and actually through my mantras Krishna gets the strength to hold the hill. So Mother Yashoda walks up to Krishna and she goes like, Krishna, she sees that his hand is shaking a little bit, so she asks, Krishna, you sure that you don't want to eat anything? And Krishna goes like, no, I'm okay, I'm satisfied. Mother Manga goes like, you speak for yourself, bring them yourself.
Nice. Yeah, that's there are so many books describing his pastimes, which bring all kinds of little details like that. Oh, you're staying.
10 minutes. Always the influence of Yoga Maya when the residents of Vrindavan are forgetting that Krishna is God. Because, like in Vatsasenya Maharaj describes as well, that when the cowherd boys are playing, nobody wants Krishna on their team, like they're playing team sports. Nobody wants Krishna on their team because he always loses, or he always does something silly and he messes up. So it seems like also to his activities, no one is really thinking he can be God, you know, because things put in the end of music.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Krishna reinforces that also. Although he's not always losing, he's also winning. You know. There's so many varieties in his pastimes, obviously. Yeah. But yeah, it's like Krishna's human-like nature makes him look like anything but God, because he seems to have all the human limitations. And then he does. Then he lifts the hill. That's the weird thing.
We see that the residents of Vrindavan very often consider Krishna to be a demigod. And we see that second offense says that if we equate events to equate Krishna for the demigods. How come there's not an offense in that part?
Second offense is to consider the name of Krishna to be like the name of the demigods means that we think that Krishna becomes the order supplier just like the demigods. So that's the offense. If we start thinking that just by chanting this name, so many auspicious things will come, just like we expect in demigod worship. So it's a fruitive type of worship. But the residents of Vrindavan, they're not really... They love Krishna. They're not worshipping him in that way. And they see that he does have extraordinary power. That he does exceptional things. So they think, well, maybe... You know, maybe he's a demigod or something. Like he must get that power somewhere. So maybe he's a demigod. Then. So it's rather, but they actually think no, he's actually a human being like us. And finally, when they really strongly begin to believe that Krishna is a demigod, then they think, then we must be demigods also. Because we are, you know, all equally powerful. So if Krishna is a demigod, then the next thought is, oh, then we are also. Yeah. And we are also. So it's different. It's not like that they're approaching Krishna as an order supplier with a fruitive intent when they call him a demigod. It's just due to forgetfulness of his position as the Lord, but they can see due to his extraordinary behavior. That's why they see him as a demigod. Different mood.
I want to know why Krishna playing the flute? Why not some other instruments?
Chinali goes.
Harmonium.
He's a piano player. So. Anyway, the now these kind of questions are the. This is a banana question. You know what I mean? Why are the bananas round, you know? That's, huh? Yeah, why? I don't know. Why are they That's good. Because Krishna wants. He wants. Because he's a person. He likes. Krishna likes the flute. He likes flute. He can play other things also, but he likes flute. Obviously, yeah. It's like he has a taste. He's a person with taste, and that's what it is. And he's the designer. You know what I mean? It's like this morning. I did the puja of my Shila, and the last few days Janani Vas did it. And like, you know, maybe he'll come in and he'll ask me, why, you know? Why? Why a yellow crown? You know? Because I like it. How can you like it? I do. I like that one. And so I guess the way Krishna manifests himself is because he likes it. It's his taste. He likes flute. It's very subtle. His bamboo flute especially. And it's from the forest. Right? It's a natural thing. Right? It's sort of. I mean, if you'd have to play a piano, it'd be a little. Carry that thing into the forest all the time. It's like. Six coward boys. So it fits in the ras also, in the mood of where he is, you know, like they are very intimately connected with the forest. They decorate themselves with the fruits and flowers and leaves of the forest. They play football. Why not with balls? They play with fruits from the forest. And a piece of bamboo. It's kind of very so. It's also part of that whole forest setting. Which is very intimate, very close. And it also says yesterday, you know, like, so all the bamboos are very proud and very happy, you know, like, means, you know. It's one of our family bamboos. It's like, yeah, it's a cousin of mine, you know. Yeah, he hangs out with Krishna all the time. So, And then Krishna must have many other reasons that are way beyond my what I can imagine. Okay. You can go, but he cannot go.
She asked for me.
Yeah, sorry. I'll let her go, but you? No. Everyone has to ask one question. Yes, one.
It's talking about forest. Is the forest called Sutala?
Mm.
Does this connect with Tamala trees and Kadava trees?
Mm-hmm.
You may tell me more about this forest.
I don't know so much about the forest.
Let's ask a question.
I have to go.
Something.
Next time.
Okay.
Thank you for everything.
Got the hats.
Yes.
It's good. Many trucks of hats they had, huh? The whole city got these hats. Yeah, have a good journey.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna. It's one of the planetary systems, right? In the Bhagavatam it is described there are different planetary systems, and it's one of the planetary systems. And in these planetary systems, each one has a different nature, and I can't remember exactly what, like, which tree is where and so on. I'd have to really look in the book, and it's the sort of thing I forget. But so there are. There's that famous mango tree that like has mangoes as big as elephants that fall and causes rivers of mango juice. There are kadamba trees also in these various places. So it's like that. But still those kadamba trees are not the same as the kadamba trees in Vrindavan or in Mayapur, because they are desire trees, they're spiritual ones. So those are the real ones that we are interested in. And Kadamba is interesting because Kadamba is golden in color. Tamala is blackish. So Srimati Radharani is represented by Kadamba trees and Krishna by Tamala trees. It's blackish. So Krishna especially, when he's in a Kadamba forest, is remembering Srimati Radharani. And it says he hangs the flowers in his ears, something like we used to, he takes two flowers and the stems together like we used to hang cherries on our ears. You did also in China? As kids? And they didn't do in China? Chinese people do that? They do. In Holland also. It's like, actually in our garden we had a cherry tree and then you'd hang two cherries like that on your ear. You never did? Oh yeah, I did many times. Next time I have some cherries, I'll bring them over. Anyway, the Kadamba flowers are like balls. They are yellow balls. And yeah, nice. Especially in Mayapur, they're very big. And Davan is small. In England, I don't know. In South Africa, you can. In Durban, they have. In Durban, very nice. In the temple, part of Sarati Maharaj, he has brought so many trees, and they have everything. Tamal tree, Kadamba tree, Parijata, so many trees there. But England, maybe too cold. In China, I think you can grow them. In some parts. Because China is very big, so the warmer parts of China you can grow them.
South China.
Yeah, not in Beijing. Beijing is cold. Okay, lots of people still have to ask questions before I let them go. Yes. It is said that Krishna goes to Ter Kadamba, you know, and at Ter Kadamba he sits in a Keli Kadamba tree. Now that we're talking about Kadambas, and that he has there, then he chants on his japa mala, and each, which is made of gems, and each of them he is counting the name of a cow. He has different herds of cows, and each herd has one head. Yeah? So he chants all the names of those heads of the cow, of the groups of cows, and then so he calls out that name. Next, calls out that, and then they all respond. In this way, he chants his rounds and brings all his herds of cows in. Like that.
Also, that when Krishna calls,
every individual cow hears Krishna calling him directly, even though he's saying one name, every cow hears their own name, that Krishna's calling him. Wonderful Krishna is all we can say. It's no end, huh? No end. Yeah. Yeah, there's so many amazing things about Krishna. Like a few days ago I was reading that during the Rasa dance, when Krishna expands himself, that he's actually not expanding himself. Because Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur said that would not be Vrindavan, that would be more suitable for Dwarka with the Aishwarya. Therefore, there's only one Krishna in the whole Rasa dance. And when you see many Krishnas, it's because he moves very fast. So he very, very, very quickly goes from one to the other. So it looks like there are many Krishnas, but actually there's only one. So, wonderful Krishna, what can we say? There's just no limit. Okay,
I was just thinking, why it was so difficult for the residents of Raj to accept the fact that he's like Supreme Personality of Godhead? For example, while he was holding the hill, they were still looking at him like he's a boy.
Yeah.
Was that because of Krishna didn't want it? He would do that to...
No, because they don't want it. They don't want it because as soon as they start thinking he's God, and then they have to go on their knees, and then they have to just, you know... then it creates a distance, and it interferes with their village relationship that they have with Krishna. You know what I mean? Krishna's my friend, Krishna's my son. You know what I mean? So, as soon as you start seeing your son as God, you have a baby, and it's like your baby, you know, and then suddenly he's God. It spoils the whole baby effect, I guess. That's what it is. That's what it is.
I thought that Krishna was doing that because he wanted to enjoy his life.
No, but they also, they don't want to know Krishna's God. They don't want to know it. They rationalize it out. They just block it out. No. He's God, yeah, but actually it doesn't matter because he's my son. Yeah, and he's my son and he's wonderful, this, that. Huh? God? Oh yeah, he was God. Yeah. But it doesn't matter because he's my son. So they are so absorbed in that relationship of which they have in the village as a son, a friend. This God idea just interferes with it. So they block it out. And Yoga Maya helps them to block it out. Like that. More? Yeah?
Yeah. Should we also follow that example to try to make that kind of relationship?
Eventually, when we get advanced. I mean, maybe now we're a little, still premature. You know. Maybe we first have to go through a phase where we actually, when we walk in the temple, where we actually remind ourselves, this is God, right? Otherwise, you go like the mind goes, nice statue, Hare Krishna, Om Vishnu Pada, and then you bow down. So we first have to go through the exercise of bowing down, and that's why Prabhupada says we're worshipping Radha and Krishna as Lakshmi Narayan, in the mood of Lakshmi Narayan, in awe and reverence and with respect and so on. So that later on, when we thoroughly accept it in our heart, yes, here is God, then we can start forgetting it. But we are at the stage that it's good for us to remember it. So, in the advanced stage, then you can forget. Then you forget it automatically. Yeah?
I'm sorry, does Krishna also choose to be under influence of Yoga Maya?
It says he is, and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur again is one who gives a lot of information about it. Sarartha Darsini, the commentary on the 10th canto, is really nice to read because it fills in so many of these kind of details. So that's a very nice book to read. He's talking about Ananda Vrindavan Champu. That's also a book that fills in details. Another one which I like very much is the Gopal Champu from Jiva Goswami. So there are all these commentaries on these pastimes, give a lot of information. And what did you ask again? I forgot.
Does it choose to be under influence of Yoga
Maya? Yeah, so then he says that that when a cowherd boy comes up from behind and covers Krishna's eyes and says, who am I? That then Krishna really doesn't know. It's he has to guess. It's not that Krishna will say, I am the all-knowing Supreme Personality of Godhead. I knew, even before you thought about it, that you would be coming here today and cover my eyes. You know, no fun. Who would want to play with Krishna? I cannot play with him anymore. Forget it. Yeah. So, therefore, Krishna also agrees to be covered by Yoga Maya. So he also forgets. And when Radharani rejects him, then he's really brokenhearted. He's not just acting. Otherwise, Krishna, everyone else would put real feelings, and Krishna would just be in there, like, you know. Yeah. How can you be really devastated if you know that tomorrow everything will be all right? Mm-hmm. I know past, present, and future. You know. So Krishna also gets covered by Yoga Maya. Who else? Material.
Okay.
You're first. You spoke.
Okay. Why does Krishna choose India to be to have his pastimes
here? India.
Everybody sees that Krishna consciousness is like a Hindu cult.
Mm-hmm.
So why did he choose India? Why is it in the east?
Yeah, why not in South Africa? He saves so much travel cost. Not fair. Yeah. I think, you know, if Krishna would have appeared in Durban, he would have had to stay on the Govardhan Hill because it always rains in Durban. When I'm there. Whenever I'm there, they always say, oh, it's because you're here. So different places, they have different karma. and places are pious and impious. And obviously, the places where we have been, where we've taken birth, are not pious places. So that means we were not pious souls. Yeah? So we were put in these places because we're not so pious. And India is the place for pious souls. So, therefore, whatever it is a place of devotees, natural devotees. Whereas, you know, like in the Netherlands alone, it's not entirely like that. That's not a place of devotees. A place of business people, money, you know. It's like, just now there was I was there and an old friend, I have this friend who is a giant. It's like 2 meters something high, and he's also huge, you know, it's just like it's a mountain of a man. And he was born in Holland, but when he was 6 years old, his father took him to Australia. And then recently, he came over to Holland, and he asked me to meet him there. So I did. And then he wanted to go to the museums. He's a painter also, so I had to go to these museums, where I hadn't been for 40 years, you know. The Dutch museums, the Dutch glories, and you see like all these, you see all these Dutch government people and explorers, you know, the guy, you see all the ships, and you see like some admiral with his hand on the globe, you know. Conquering the earth. Yeah, that's what they did. Yeah. So that's not pious. Yeah. And then, of course, they had a golden age in the 17th century, and we learned I learned in school that it came from spices. Black spices. Because there's nothing in the history books that the Netherlands have shipped about 2 to 10 million slaves, I'm not even sure how many. Probably closer to 10 than to 2. Officially, 2 is sort of kind of known, but rumor has 10. That's a lot of people to move in these ships, 10 million people. That's inconceivable. A lot of money made also. So it's not pious. So it's not a pious culture, not pious history. So much impiety in the language. All the proverbs, you know, we have many proverbs in the Dutch language which are not vegetarian. You know, so I sort of like don't know what to. there's something. There's meat in them. You know. So, what to do? If you look a little deeper at South Africa, it's also not a pious place. Even Sarajevo is not a place of saints. Or the UK is not really okay. So yeah, Bharat is the place for piety, pious souls. Krishna appears there where his devotees are. But maybe in the future he'll appear in South Africa if we make many devotees. Any?
But sometimes someone could say that Bharat is
us,
but Krishna appeared there. That's where so many people are
so affected. The chicken or the egg? which was first? Well, Krishna chose to put his devotees there. Let's see it like that. You know, it's all a Krishna, this karmana devane trana, by karma and by divine arrangements, we are all being placed in different places. So Krishna put all his devotees there. It's by far the land of the devotees. There's nothing that compares to it. Nowhere in the world. Not even South Africa. You know, the people from India, they have a spirit, you know. Then you go to the Kumbh Mela, and we just go all by bus, and I'm on this bus also, and then in the middle of the night, we're driving the whole night on this bus, and we're supposed to reach early morning. And then suddenly, somewhere in the, we're still in the middle of the road, still many hours to go, suddenly there's police, they stop it, and then they start like beating on the bus with bamboo sticks and say, you have to park it, here, park it. Yeah, we can park it, where? Some field, you know. Anyway, they force us to park the bus in the field. And say, yeah, the buses are not going any further, they have to stay here, they have to walk, yeah. And, okay, you know, the whole bus is everyone's in good spirits. And okay, we go walk. So we start walking, and after about 20 minutes walking, somebody says, which way is it actually? And then everybody says, I don't know. And then, but we're walking, you know. And then we turn around, and, you know, after some argument, which way it is, and then... But eventually we get there, you know, we get there. And this was Kumbh Mela in Haridwar. So eventually we got to Haridwar. And then somehow or other we came to Haridwar and we just, first it's 7-8 hours in an old Indian bus, you know, and then like 4 hours of walking. And then we came to this place, freezing cold. And there's the Ganga, ice water coming out of the mountain, you know, like the sort of water, like... And all these people, you know... I go, like, I'll wait for 20 minutes for the sun to rise before I jump in, you know. It's like... So much eagerness, and they have no place to stay. No place to stay, they just stay in a pandal. You know, they go to the pandal program, sit down, and after the program, they just lie down in the same pandal where the program is. I mean, these people, they are eager, you know. And we go, oh, well, yeah, I don't know. And maybe I'll go to Kumbh Mela, but I mean, I don't know if the hotel is nice. And, you know, it's like, do they have warm water? And it's like, you know. And how do you get there? You go by bus. Oh, I heard you have to walk in the night. I don't really want to walk in the night. I think I'll stay home and look at it on TV. I'll check it on the internet. That's why we're impious. Because these people, you can't stop them. You can't stop them. They're so eager. It's just amazing. So pious souls take their birth. Who else? Yes, my turn.
Sometimes I feel like now we have cars at the Shushanathana temple. And previously, told to take Sankalpas.
Okay.
And there were Sankalpas like devotees wanted to chant extra rounds like that. Mm-hmm. And chant their rounds before Brahmaputra. So my question is.
I'm waving at the Zoom and at the video record.
So my question is Sankalpa a vow that we take? What happens if we sometimes
can... Yeah. I think that such vows are... it's a little tricky because in the nectar of devotion... It says that we should not take vows. If you look at at the regulative principles of devotional service, then it's mentioned there that we should not take such vows. At the same time, we take vows of initiation. But in general, we're not recommended to take on extra vows. So I think these sankalpas are good intentions, and that if we have taken a serious sankalpa, I would recommend that you reconfirm it with your spiritual master. You know, it's like if you have decided that from now on I'm going to every day chant 42 rounds, just get that reconfirmed with your spiritual master and see if that's really what he wants you to do. And if he wants you to take such a vow, because I feel in many cases, I've met some devotees who've taken such a vow and they got in great trouble with it. They couldn't maintain it, actually. It created so much stress, and then they were desperate. They came to me and they said, okay, I relieved them from the vow. I said, I'll transfer the responsibility on my head, right, that, you know, you will be relieved from this vow, and I'll ask Krishna to on the strength of my instruction to you, to let it go. And if there's any reaction, then I'll take that. Because I think Srila Prabhupada gave us 16 rounds as a vow. Right? Not 64, not 32, not 48. And I don't think that we should make Krishna consciousness more difficult than it is. On the other hand, it's nice to chant more rounds. Yeah? So I'm a little hesitant about taking this as vows. Of course, I have all respect for the sincere attempt of everyone. But if you have taken a big, big vow, you have to reconfirm it with me. All my disciples, if they take, they cannot take any such vows without reconfirming them with me. Yeah. And that's my instruction to all my disciples, even the ones who are not here. And how other spiritual masters wish to deal with additional vows is to them. And I'm just concerned that people may prematurely take big vows without being able to oversee it. You know, it's just like, you know, a child may say, I want to, you know, I'll do big things, and I cannot oversee it, what you're doing. Say you promise to chant 40 rounds every day. Have you calculated getting sick? Say, you have promised it, but did you consider that? Are you going to do it when you're in the hospital with an operation? And what's going to happen about the vow? Then you will not chant? Then what will happen? Can you deal with the reactions then of breaking the vow? So it cannot be taken with the same seriousness as an initiation vow. So I have some concern about it. That so I would like my disciples to discuss it with me, what they're doing. If they want it. Because I really feel that's between me and my disciples, you know, that we are fixing a number of rounds and so on. So I don't think you should take vows about anything that you're going to do then outside of the vows that you're promising in initiation. If you want to take more vows, then you should. That's really a matter that you should take up with your spiritual master.
Does that include the Kartik notes also?
Yeah, but you get from me the permission to take Kartik vows. So, blessed. But I always say at the beginning of every Kartik, don't overdo it. Yeah. You know, don't overdo it. Don't take on too much. And in Kartik vows, I prefer you put the emphasis on hearing and chanting, and not so much on fasting and, you know, and taking Panchagavya or something, you know, like, I mean, you take, in the last 5 days, you take some day, take some cow urine and cow dung and all that. I don't think it's required. I'm not particularly impressed. Jai Hare Krishna. Prabhupada didn't do anything like that. Didn't introduce anything like cow dung, so I don't think it's required. You don't have to take cow dung. Just chant Hare Krishna. Of course, you maybe like cow dung. Even then, still, you don't have to take it. Like, I have some disciples that like to eat tilak. Still, like, I don't recommend it to you. But it's so tasty. Who ate the tilak?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I was just wondering about the significance of names. For example, as soon as I came here, I was asking who named the Jagadesha and why. And also I was wondering about, like, the different temples that I visited, Kishore Kishore and Shishi Radha Radhanath and Radha Gopinath. I was just wondering about that and Radha Shamsun.
No.
I was just wondering about the significance of names.
Well, different. It's personal. So different Vaishnavas are in positions of leadership at different points in time, and then they can choose names. So, somehow or other, it was Bhagavan Prabhu who in Europe was a powerful leader, and also in South Africa, and who did a lot of service for Srila Prabhupada, and he got all these castles. This one, New Mayapur, the one in Spain, he built a temple, he got one in Italy, he built a temple in Durban. So, because he was the leader at the time, under him, many of these big projects were developed, and he chose the names of the deities, and of course, you know, he didn't just sit in his room at a drawing board and say, like, well, let's have these and these deities. Oftentimes, okay, they may have decided, in this place we'll have deities that are a little bigger, in this place that are a little smaller. So, but then the Murti carvers, right? Yeah, they present some deities. Well, we have these forms, we have those. Yeah. And then they make choices. Or they say, you go to them, you say, we want like 4 feet carved white marble deities, and they start carving, and, you know, it's very difficult. For a short time, put in charge when they were carving 4 of the 8 gopis in Mayapur. And, you know, I had to go there every once in a while, and then these people are carving, and they were carving on the face. And then the Murtiwala goes, what do you think? You know, what do you think? Should I take off a little bit more, or take off? And I was like, I don't know. Because I have to see it first, you know. I mean, couldn't picture it in my mind. I said, I can, when it's taken off and it's too much, it's okay, put it back. Yeah. But, you know, to see it in my mind, right? Like, you know, take a little bit off. I'm supposed to see it in my mind. I couldn't see it in my mind. I had to see it with my eyes. So I was getting totally mental. And you will also see, if you look at the Asasakis, that some, that four of the gopis are a little bit more round cheeks than the other ones. It's my fault. Okay. Yeah. It's my fault. I'm sorry. The movement will have to live with it. I guess I wasn't the right guy for this. I just couldn't do it. I was scared, you know. I was like, oh God, what if I take off too much? I can't put it, glue it back. And so it's very personal. So it's like Bhagavan gave these names, and you'd really have to ask him or somebody who were with him at the time. I wasn't so close to him. We didn't gel so well. But I respect him. And Radha Gopinath, yeah, okay, I guess because Radha Gopinath is sweet and Radharani is kind of very, a bit prominent. I guess they called it Radhadesh because of that reason. Although another meaning of Radhadesh is referring to the place in Bengal where the Ganga doesn't flow. Obviously this Radhadesh is referring to Radharani and Radha Gopinath and the land of Radha Gopinath. That was what they were intending, so we take it like that. Land of Radha. Land of Radha, Gopinath. Gopinath, who is controlled by Radha, therefore the land is named after her, Radhadesh. I guess that's what he was thinking. But I'm guessing, because he didn't tell me. You can ask Hridaya Chaitanya. You can ask Hridaya Chaitanya, the temple president. Just ask him. He'll be happy to tell you. He's very friendly. Yeah?
The morning class today, you wrote some very many, I don't really remember the full thing. It was a verse, you said, akarma, karma, sarva, sarva.
Akarma, sarva, karma, moksha, karma, karma. Yeah.
Yeah, can you explain that a little bit? I think it was Brihat Bhagavat Maharaj that used that verse, the center point for his seminar that took 5 days, and I was too young to remember it. But I remember the tune of it, and when he said it many years later, trying to understand what it meant, or it was for, I think, Nectar of Instruction.
It may be quoted in some purport, but it comes up actually in the Bhagavatam, in the narration of Dhruva Maharaj. And then it is said, whether you have material desires or whether you don't have material desires, you should with great force engage in pure devotional service. So if you look at it, you think, how can you engage in pure devotional service when you have material desires? Huh? But if you look at it, it says, tivrena bhakti yogena, that you should, tivrena means like the full blast of the sun, so without any shade, full force. It's translated as full force. It's also translated as unadulterated. So whether you have material desires or don't have material desires, you should apply yourself to the pure, unadulterated process of devotional service. And then you'll be purified. That's what it means. So, in other words, it's not about our state of consciousness, but it's about that we simply apply ourselves to the pure process of bhakti. And then all good results will come.
I think one of the themes, if I remember, was Yukta
Vairagya
that he attached to
this verse. Yeah, but then you have to ask Maharaj, because I can't always understand someone else's train of thought, you know what I mean? It's from sitting here, I can't figure that out. First of all, I didn't hear it, and if I would have heard it, I could say something, but I didn't hear it, so I don't get it from you like that. I mean, you have to ask him. Next time, you see him, just ask him. It's in March, so many years ago, you gave this class. Sometimes people come with a clash, and I usually go, like, oh. Why don't you? I can't even remember what I said this morning. But Maharaj is very systematic, so he may still remember it. Who raised the hand here? I saw a hand. You.
Slightly off topic though, but because we were talking earlier about Krishna and his pastimes, but I was wondering about Lord Chaitanya when he was younger. If it says in the scripture anything about what he was like and what was his likes and dislikes.
Lots of things. He was wild. He used to fight with other boys. He even had a gang. He used to he used to cheat his parents by he would harass proud brahmanas and I've often told them, but he would swim underwater. These Brahmins were chanting their Gayatri, and then he'd swim underwater and pull their legs and fall over. Or worse, he would sit on the bank of the Ganga. The Brahmins would come out, and then Nimai had some water in his mouth, and he would spit it on them. What mercy, huh? Then the Brahmins would all go to his father to complain, and then Nimai would come home, and he had ink spots on his body, dust, his hair was dry. So, it's like, I took bath. I was never at the Ganga today. Mm-hmm. And his friends would say, oh, very smart. He was like that.
And what did he like to eat?
What did he like to eat? Well, Well, yeah, he liked to eat spinach, that's true, but there were other preparations also that Mother Sachi used to make for him. And she would cook very, very tasty, opulent preparations for him. You would eat these things. There's a list in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. But I can't do it off memory.
One more question about Chaitanya. I heard somewhere that the followers of Lord Chaitanya, or the devotees of ISKCON, they are they have a personal relationship in the spiritual world with Krishna.
With who?
With Krishna in the spiritual world.
Mm-hmm.
Is this true?
The associates of Lord Chaitanya have a personal relationship with Krishna.
Yeah, so in other words, they don't have an impersonal relationship in the spiritual world.
But who has an impersonal relationship in the spiritual world?
Like the grass and the trees.
No, it's also personal. Very personal. The grass and the trees are also personal. Some say that Madhavendapuri is a tree in the spiritual world. A desire tree, so they say. Some say. Although I've never heard it from Srila Prabhupada or from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, but still, they say. No, Uddhava is praying to be a blade of grass. There's no personal and impersonal relationship. We all have personal relationships. There are different rasas. There is Santaras, Dasyaras, Sakyaras, and so on. So generally the associates of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu are in the three higher rasas, it is said, generally, by the mercy of Mahaprabhu. And that's probably where you're coming from. Where the personal nature of the relationship is more more intense than maybe in the somewhat passive relationship with the grass. But even the grass is active in service, even the grass is trying to be extra soft when Krishna is around, or, you know, or, and the trees, they start shaking, and rain flowers, or drip honey, or make nice flowers when there's a sweet breeze blowing, so the trees are also active. No. So you can't say there's a personal and impersonal relationship, but the intensity of the loving exchange may be deeper in the higher rasas. That we have everyone.
In Krishna Maharaj Maharaj, even Ram only ate one Vajina, was very strict. I wonder if Krishna has ever had 16,108, where has that come from?
Yeah. First of all, Lord Ramachandra was showing an example for the people of this earth. And his whole life was dedicated to that, to show the example of Dharma. We're showing that, like, to take so many wives is really not like so much required. Just be faithful to one wife. He's showing an example like this. But Krishna, he comes to show us the activities of the spiritual world. And Krishna, he can have so many devotees. Krishna is not limited to give shelter to one devotee. So that's Krishna has so many wives because he can give shelter to so many devotees. And then, yeah, there were a whole group of princesses who were kidnapped. Huh? They were kidnapped by this Bhomasura, it was. He had kidnapped all these princesses, so then Krishna came there and he freed all these princesses, and they said, now what are we going to do? We've been captured by this man and stayed in the house of another man. No one will marry us anymore. So what are we going to do there? Now you'll have to marry us. Yeah. So Krishna agreed. So he got him one time 16,000 wives. And the other 108 he picked up here and there on the way. Huh? You have one.
Maybe we could just comment on it's a common thing that people say it's Krishna's arrangement that this happened. So, I mean, how... I don't know how to phrase it, but like how... What's the significance of Krishna's role in our karma and our activities? I mean, it's a big...
Yeah. Okay, good question. Krishna is Anumanta and Upadrasta. Upadrasta means he is the overseer, he is the witness. Anumanta means he is giving anumiti or permission. So as So, not a blade of grass moves without Krishna's will, and so on. So, when it comes to our karma, Krishna is there allowing it all. He can interfere if he wants. Yeah. But he allows it all to happen. He allows this. So the karma is just like static electricity, you know. If you rub it, like, you get a certain electric charge, right? And then, yeah, it has to discharge. So by friction with material interaction, a karmic charge has built up. Now it has to discharge. So I have to wait till it discharges. So Krishna just lets that process go on, just as he lets the process of the wind, the blowing of the wind, go on, or of the rising and setting of the sun. It's just the process he lets go. But he's witnessing it all. And if he wants, he can interfere with it. So with his devotees, he does. So with the devotees, he sometimes interferes. He diminishes the karmic reaction. So this one, okay, we write it off. You know, that one, take it off the bill. Like that, Krishna becomes personally involved in our karma. Therefore, when something happens to us, what is it? Is it Krishna or is it karma? You ultimately say, well, ultimately Krishna. But Krishna may use our karma, you know, like that. When your suitcase gets lost, not that it will happen, but I say it's like, if someone's suitcase gets lost, Krishna Kirtan was traveling with me to South Africa, and his suitcase got lost, and he walked 3 days in a towel. no clothes. Yeah, staying in Govardhan's house. Govardhan wasn't there. He walked in a towel. He didn't want to borrow one of Govardhan's suits. So he just bought a towel. It's in a towel and a t-shirt. Karma. Yeah. Why his suitcase? Not mine. The thing is coming. You've already been, let's see.
Now, I understand that Krishna is a person and can do whatever he wants to. But the one pastime where Krishna steals butter from the different devotees' houses, and he doesn't find the butter, he just passes you. Why does it do that?
What about that?
Why does it do that?
Shit, I was like, ask him. Just go to the temple and ask him. Krishna, why are you doing that? I guess he's still very small, you know, so he's still a boy, so it's like a child, so children do. It's more within what a child can do, right? Yeah. So it's a way that a child takes revenge. Right? It's a childish way of taking revenge. Works. Lord Chaitanya, of course, also did something outrageous with passing urine. You may remember the story of Murari's plate, right? I think in relation to preaching impersonal philosophy. These are the inconceivable ways. I have to pull the inconceivable card out right for this one. These are the inconceivable ways of the Lord. Yadarani. Just see. Even that is a blessing. When Krishna passes urine in your house, yes. Anytime. Yeah, you're most welcome. Anytime, wherever you like. It's all yours. And we haven't cleaned that place since.
Earlier there was a question about humility. I just wanted to know if you could comment on that humility is not just usually associated with being meek and very quiet. It's like humility is sometimes to have to speak up or to have to ask a question or to have to say if there's something that you need.
Yes. Yeah, humility is very tricky because it's not about externals. It's not just about being very soft-spoken. That's not necessarily a sign of humility. Humility really means that we are becoming an instrument and that we just put our own agenda aside and that we just allow ourselves to be guided by the superior directions of a superior personality, which is very difficult because we don't trust. Humility means therefore we must trust that if we just follow the directions of a superior person, that the result will be better than if we rely on our own intelligence. So false pride means relying on our own intelligence so much, and then, well, you know, I'm not going to do that, you know, I mean, I'm not crazy, I mean, like, yeah. But humility means, no, whatever the superior personality really wants, all right, even if we're a little afraid to do it. Yeah, so your point is deep, thoughtful, nice, appreciate it. Yeah, good point. Almost at everyone. I guess Krishna Kripa and Radha Kripa have to take lunch in this room today. They're not coming out.
In the morning's class, you were talking about Aparad, devotee Aparad. And I wanted to ask the question when the time was gone. What happens in a family of devotees? And say, for instance, I say Sri Govinda did something wrong. Sorry, sir. And I call it in you. Much
you call them sweet words. You pumpkin.
I've got this donkey brain.
Oh, donkey brain. Okay.
Donkey brain and why
is that what she used to call you? I'm going to remember that one.
Because presently in South Africa, around the world, in France and all, the people are eating donkey meat. It's mixed up with all the...
Oh, yuck.
So there was one gentleman told that why in South Africa practically everybody is so dumb? Because they eat donkey meat. Now, like I was telling you, I tell Sri Govinda, why you got donkey brains? I told you to do this and you didn't do it. I lose it. Right,
again,
do I
incur karma
or?
Yeah. Well. According to Sri Govinda, you do. I got it. It's we all do it. You know what I mean? We all do it. We all call somebody idiot or you know at times. I do it. Of course, as a spiritual master, you get away with it. You can, no, I can call you idiot anytime. A disciple always stays a fool before a spiritual master. All right. Just let you know. What about this? Well. The offense comes in when we are getting really derogative, when we are getting in the mood of putting someone down, right? It's not in ordinary interaction, you know, when someone drops a pot of with warm milk on the floor or the soup and it's all over the floor and it's like, oh, you know, idiot or donkey brain, right? That's definitely an occasion to pull the donkey brain off the shelf, right? Someone was serving prasadam and was always like putting one preparation on top of the other, right? So finally one sannyasi said, all right, yeah, he's serving the sweet rice. And sannyasi come, come on, yes, put it in the salt. Yes, yes, put it in the salt. Put it in the salt. And he's standing like, put it in the salt. Yeah? And then finally, that devotee put it in the salt. Put the sweet rice in the salt. And then he goes, do you have any brains? It was a little heavy, but okay, we have to, sometimes some chastisement is part of normal human interaction. People do stupid things, and, you know, like when, you know, not this servant, but another servant, right? I taught him a Dutch proverb which says, like, that, you know, that a donkey in general doesn't hit his leg on the same stone, you know, twice. Like once he hits a stone, but the second time he's learned a lesson, you know. So, yeah, when people get even, so basically it means in a nice way, you're more stupid than a donkey, right, for doing it twice. How many times do I have to tell you? So this is not Vaishnava aparad, this is just normal human interaction. Yeah. But when we start to go after someone, it's like, you know, this Kadambakana Swami, I think he's not really a Vaishnava. I think he's an envious snake. And I think that, you know, it's like you go after him, right? Like really to, in a derogative way. Then it starts to become envious, vicious. Now we get in the realm of aparad. But in the normal, you know, interaction where it slips out, you idiot, or you donkey brain, or this or that. No, I don't think there's any reaction if you call Sri Govinda donkey brain. Now it's authorized. I think it's good for him. And I think you're his mother. And a mother has a right to call her son donkey brain. No problem. You know. I think so. Yeah, there's your son. You can call him donkey brain. Yeah. Okay, there's a few who didn't ask questions. I'll forgive them. I know exactly who they are. Myself, so because I can leave you behind in the room. But I appreciate all the questions. It makes it a little more lively than just a monologue.